The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today's episode is all about animal conservation. First, because they need our help, and second, because a lot of it is probably our fault. My first guest is the pseudonymed Bug Girl of Bug Girl's blog. Bug has a PhD in entomology, and her bug research involves using pheromones to try to control insect populations without pesticides. Lovely to have you back, Bug.
Thanks.
Okay, so let's start with exactly why we should conserve insects, because I don't know if you're aware, but not everyone loves them as much as you do, my friend.
I know. It's a constant disappointment to me. It's a hard case to make because they're little and they scurry. And generally, that's not associated with cuteness and cuddliness. But the reality is, this is not the planet of the apes. This is the planet of the insects. The vast majority of species on this planet that have more than one cell are insects. Actually, beetles. There are more kinds of beetles than anything else on Earth. So when we think about conservation, typically we think about big charismatic mammals. Charismatic megafauna is kind of the name for it. You know, a rhino, an elephant, a tiger. And problem is, that's really, if you think about all of the things with backbones, so fish, tigers, elephants, birds, everything, things with backbones, that's 3% of life on Earth. It's just big and we see it. But the reality is, it's the little things that run the world. And one of the big concepts that's really gotten a lot of traction lately is ecosystem services. So we get a lot of stuff for free by just living on Earth. You know, the plants make oxygen and water is purified by, you know, passing through mountains, aquifers, whatever. There are things here we can eat. And a lot of that just happens. We don't have to actually pay for it. And so we take it for granted until it breaks. And so for insects, they support us in a variety of ways that we never really think about. I mean, I think people are starting to get more aware that, oh, pollination is important because pollination is related to our food. And that gets a fair amount of press, but there's actually a whole lot of other things that insects do for us that we don't appreciate. I mean, I think the biggest one is garbage disposal. If we did not have dung beetles, if we didn't have blowflies, if we didn't have essentially a whole crew of insects with a literally shit-eating grin, we would be in big trouble. If you think about it, what would happen if none of the dinosaurs decomposed or none of the dinosaur flop decomposed? What if, you know, something dies out on the road, right? Deer constantly being hit, raccoons, porcupines. The primary decomposer of those things is insects. They start the process. There's a lot of bacterial things that happen as well, but insects really start the process and break the body apart. Or they literally pick up the poop and move it from place to place. If we didn't have that, we would be a lot more than knee deep in, yeah.
Oh. Well, and how do they do that precisely?
Well, it's food. If you think about a blowfly, when something dies, and we'll just go with, let's say, a porcupine on the side of the road, as soon as a vertebrate dies, it starts releasing this really wonderful compound called cadaverin that blowflies are just incredibly sensitive to. And they show up and they start laying eggs. And usually, if there's a wound, that's where they're going to lay them, or they'll just fill up, you know, the eyes, the nose, the mouth with eggs. The eggs hatch, maggots start eating, and as they grow and get bigger, they break that body apart. I mean, it's part of nutrient cycling. I mean, there's the obvious messy part of we would like things that die or poop that's lying around. We would like it to go away. But the other important part of making it go away is that it's not really going away. It's going back into the soil as nutrients and becoming available for other organisms. So if we had a functioning ecosystem, we wouldn't have to put fertilizer on things because things would be moving back and forth between, you know, the animals, the plants, the bacteria, the atmosphere. When that falls apart, then we have to start paying people to run around and scoop the poop or haul things off and put it in a dump. Part of what the idea behind ecosystem services is putting a price tag on the stuff we get for free. You know, we can quantify pretty easily how much it would cost us to replace bees, for example. And depending on how you calculate it, you get numbers that start at 8 billion with a B and go up to 40 billion per year.
So somebody has actually tried to cost this out.
Yes. And some of it is really pretty fascinating. I mean, some of the work that they've done, for example, in Alabama, they did a study where they basically calculated out how much individual blueberry bees contributed in blueberry pollination. So one bee will visit roughly 50,000 flowers in a year. And that creates $75 worth of berries.
Really?
There's okay. a reason why they say busy as a bee. They're busting their little hinder.
Okay. So we have pollination. We have poop eating. And what else? What other kind of ecosystem services?
You know, they're helping to break up the soil and return nutrients.
Right.
There's also provisioning. So we don't really think about it, but shellac comes from an insect. Cochineal, which is a lovely pink dye that shows up in food and candy. Silk, honey. Many, many cultures eat insects as food. And then insects are the base of so many food chains around the world because they are so abundant and very high in protein. And some of them also are quite high in fat, which is really important. You know, one of the questions I get a lot is, what good are mosquitoes? They're pretty annoying to us, but the vast majority of mosquitoes actually don't bite humans, but are fish food. Their immature stage is aquatic, and they are food for fish, frogs, and a whole bunch of other things that we do think are kind of cute and cool, but also that we eat ourselves. If you like beef, you might not really think about this, but even if you're a beef eater, alfalfa is pollinated and a major part of what gets fed to a lot of cattle as supplemental food, and that's pollinated by bees. They're so enmeshed in our food chain that we can't do without them. And there are actually places where things have happened where we have completely lost pollinators. One place where that happens really commonly is when you grow tomatoes in greenhouses. Tomatoes need a special kind of pollination, and it's called buzz pollination. And if you have a greenhouse, that's really great from the point of view of the tomato because no insects come in and chew on it. So you get a really high yield. But the problem is no bees come in either. And so essentially you have to run around with a vibrator and stimulate all of the plants.
So for real?
Yeah. I mean, essentially what a bee does, a bumblebee, the buzz pollination, they're big and they get in the flower and just and vibrate. And that plant is then triggered to release its pollen. If you don't have the vibration, the plant will not self-pollinate very well. It happens. And this also is really dependent on tomato varieties. But some of the really big ones, they set fruit better when you vibrate them.
You teach me so much.
Well, you can also, I mean, one of the other that they've done is imported bumblebees into greenhouses. Since obviously they're considerably cheaper and don't need health benefits than, you know, someone around with a vibrator up and down the rows. But the problem is they're usually introduced species, and that's not good. When you start moving things from place to place, they bring all of their parasites and diseases and other sorts of things, and then there's competition. The really interesting thing to me is how few of how little we know about the insects around us and how very important they are. And I kind of think of it, you know, our entire world is kind of like a car. We get all of these ecosystem services for free, you know, my air, my water. For the most part, especially here in North America, we don't have to worry that much about access to clean water, clean air, food. But it's kind of like we're getting rid of things by just randomly taking pieces off of our car. And you can do that for a while. Speaking as someone who's had a car that I mean, every car I've ever had, I've taken over 300,000 miles. And you can remove a lot of parts from a car before things really start getting to be a problem. We know right now that roughly 20% of insect species are estimated to be either threatened or endangered. And we've driven quite a few of them to extinction. There was a recent study that came out, I guess it was about a month ago, where they actually compared a bumblebee study in Pennsylvania in 1980 and basically went back and redid the experiment. Half the species were gone. So we can keep taking pieces off the car and throwing them away. But as passengers in the car, our experience is going to continually degrade. We're still moving forward, but we're going to have a less pleasant experience. And eventually, we will have to start paying a lot of money to make repairs just to keep things functioning the way they do now for things that used to happen without our having to intervene.
Well, what kinds of insects are endangered at this point?
Most of the insects that are endangered are insects that we don't know about very much. So things like all of the different bumblebees that used to be in the United States and Canada, the little solitary bees. There are thousands of little tiny solitary bee species doing really specific things. So they would pollinate one type of plant that was a native plant. But then we paved everything. And now we grow a lot of corn, which is not something that native bees are really interested in. Corn is mostly wind pollinated. We grow plants that are from all around the world, which native insects don't recognize as being food plants. They haven't evolved together. The IUCN is the International Union for Conservation of Nature. So IUCN issues what's called the Red List. And the red list is basically things that are threatened, endangered, or already extinct. On the IUCN list, they have only about 3% of insects, known insect species, that they have information for. If you think about how many species, you know, if 80% of multicellular organisms are insects, and we only have 3% of them in our index.
So we effectively don't know anything about insects, is what you're saying. Comparatively.
Well, comparatively, yeah. Because it's a lot harder to get people engaged and energized in saving a tiger beetle than it is to save a tiger.
Well, it depends on what kind of insect we're talking about, because just recently there was a story that was going around that you were forced to respond to about pubic lice.
Well, I should say they are not officially on the IUCN red list as a species of concern. Although that I smell a grant opportunity here.
Where did that story come from?
It's pubic lice, and people are anything that involves the groin is automatically news. and so, yeah, basically, a couple of doctors working in a public health clinic basically were sitting around one day, as best I can tell, and said, "Hey, man, we hardly ever see crabs anymore. What's up with that?" And so they basically just did a quick count and said, "Okay, here's the incidence of crabs over time, and the line goes down, and we're going to just say, we think it's because people are waxing." They didn't really have any evidence at all that connected the two. And you know, it's kind of hard to get demographic information about whether or not people still have the original carpeting, you know? Although that, again, would be a pretty fascinating study that I would love to do. and this is something I see a lot in stories about insects. If there's a story that kind of fits what we already think, we run with it. So cell phones, we're kind of not really sure about them. Somebody comes up with this idea that cell phones are going to kill bees. Yep, okay, that's it. We're going to, yeah, that totally, right. Cell phones are killing bees. No, they're not. But it makes a story that we like. So people are waxing their nether regions. And so that must mean that when there's a decline in the number of crabs, that somehow that's related to this sort of pubic deforestation.
I'm totally stealing that phrase. So, oh, okay, well, now I have a challenge for you. You say everything plays an important role in an ecosystem. Pubic lice, my friend.
Well, no, I got nothing, actually.
Sweet. All right, we can do without that one.
I will say that one of the interesting things about human lice is that they actually have let us figure out a lot of really interesting things about our own history. So you can look at the genetic structure of lice and pubic lice and essentially use that changes in lice to map out the migration of early humans throughout history. And looking also at ways in which primate lice parallel the evolution of human lice and where there are similarities and differences. So they become a really fascinating sort of genetic map for ways that we've moved around on the globe.
Okay, you win. That's fair. So if we're talking about insect conservation, then what, I guess, how are humans attempting to reverse that for the species that we would like to keep? Or are they just trying to protect the ones that are left at this point rather than trying to reverse it?
I think that's all we really can do. And at this point, the world is changing really fast. Again, going back to the International Union for Conservation reports, the two biggest threats for insects are basically habitat loss and invasive species. We have radically changed what's here for insects to eat and places for insects to live. So if you look out at the average, you know, suburban yard, there is nothing there for a bee to eat. It's green. There's no flowers. Very often people will put an awful lot of fertilizer and pesticide on it. That's really not a hospitable environment. The number one thing that lives in our yards right now is Japanese beetles, which are not native to the United States. And they'll do tons of damage. And most of the grass that you look at in the yard is not a Native American species. So going back in time is impossible. What we can do is continue what people are working on now, which is trying to put a number on things. How much would it cost if we didn't have dung beetles? What would that cost for us? And we can actually get numbers for that pretty easily. A good example is in Australia and New Zealand, where sheep came in. There were no native insects there that had evolved and knew what to do with a cow pie. And that's still an ongoing issue for those countries because their native fauna was all geared towards marsupial poop.
Right.
And so they actually have imported dung beetles to try and take care of that. And that's the whole issue of right now we're moving another species from place to place. So there's actually a lot of science behind the numbers. Another recent paper was one that looked at essentially the value of pest control. If you have a garden or if you're a farmer, there are a lot of insects out there that eat other insects or that eat specific weeds. And so you essentially get some pest control for free. And so one of these studies was basically looking at what I guess you could call biocontrol services. And the comparison between a corn and soybean in fields, sort of as far as the eye can see, versus a mixed cropping situation. When there's just one ginormous field of corn, or one ginormous field of soybeans, you really don't have a lot of natural predators. But when you have smaller fields that are mixed and you have edges, so around the edge of the field, you leave it a little weedy. and it's not clean and sort of nuked into oblivion the way that you see on a lot of farms. That actually, you get a benefit out of that. It's untidy, but that untidy piece is where the spiders can hang out, other predatory insects can hang out. Things like predatory bugs. There's some really cool assassin bugs. They're sort of like little, six like ninjas. So all of those habitats that you leave, if you have a slightly untidy field, you actually get a benefit from that. And so if you could show the numbers to a farmer, hey, you know what? If you stop mowing this section of your field and just leave that there as a weird strip, it's going to look yucky, but here's the financial benefit you get out of it. That's a compelling argument. But if I go up to a farmer who is struggling and trying to feed their family and say, hey, man, there's an endangered beetle over there. Don't mow it. That's a non-starter.
Well, I do have to ask, though. Now, you've made me, unfortunately, obsessed with poop for at least the next 15 minutes. We're almost out of time, but I have to ask. So if suddenly we were without all of the animals that, or sorry, the insects rather, that break down all of the dead things and the poop eaters and such, what would the world look like?
I'd be more concerned about what the world would smell like. But actually, there is research on this too. And just, there's some papers that I read them and I'm like, this is so bizarre. I love it. There is a group in the Midwest that was actually looking at comparative attractiveness of poop, specifically mammal poop. And so what they did was they took turds from zoo animals and different primates and then native animals. So they had an antelope and then a Native American bison. They had a chimpanzee and a human. They had a coyote and a tiger. And they put these out in little piles all over and quantified. Does it make a difference? Are native animals, native insects here in the United States more interested in native poop? Or will they basically eat anything? And I should say that in studies like this, it's pretty normal for the entomologist to contribute, if you know what I mean. It's making bait is a very long-standing entomological tradition, just saying.
Noted.
And so that's how they know that actually human poo is more attractive than gorilla poop. But generally, they were most interested in the native species. So as we continue to move things back and forth, I think we're going to have to answer that question of, here's this animal or crop that we've moved from one place to another. How are we going to deal with all of the ripple effects? And ultimately, the only thing I can say that's true for sure always is that you can never do just one thing when it comes to ecology. If you pull any thread, it is attached to something. So slowing down and being more mindful of, you know, is it really a good idea for us to import dung beetles to Australia? Let's think about that for a while before we just go get them and plop them over there. Personally, I would like for everyone to love insects, not because they're financially useful to us, but because they are beautiful and amazing. But that's not going to happen. So what we really need to do is just make that case that, no, really, there's a lot of money here that is indirectly and directly supported by insects and their services. Maybe talking about dung all the time is not the way to go with that, but still, it's a valuable service. I wouldn't want to do it.
Bug girl. We love you. Come back soon.
Okay.
You can find a link to Bug Girl and her blog on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be back in a moment to talk about animal conservation with Will Stolzenberg, author of Rat Island. Stay tuned.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. Will Stolzenberg writes and speaks on the science of saving wild creatures. Formerly science editor for Nature Conservancy magazine, he now writes books and film scripts, including the documentaries Lords of Nature and Ocean Frontiers, and the book Where the Wild Things Were. He's currently researching a story about mountain lions, and he's here today to talk about his newest book, Rat Island. Welcome to the show, Will.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you get interested in animal conservation?
Well, it's, I guess, like a lot of people, I grew up with this interest in, you know, my little plastic dinosaurs, and I knew all their names, and then and taking that outside, the bugs and the birds and the bees and stuff, and I guess a lot of people tend to outgrow those things, and I just never did.
Good for us.
Well, thank you.
Tell us a bit about the book.
The book, Rat Island, yeah, it's actually a true story. It's about this cadre of professional killers, if you will. They're on a mission to save the wildlife of the world's islands. That's my elevator speech anyway, but it involves a very interesting cast of an international crew of folks who are out there trying to make a dent in the extinction crisis, and they're doing it in one of the best, the most fertile grounds that they've been able to find, and that is the oceanic islands.
Since we're already on the topic of islands, why exactly are there so many different species of birds on those islands? And actually, specifically, so many odd kinds of birds?
That's the thing about islands. That's what's so attractive about them, is that they're these isolated bastions of evolution. And that, you know, if you're lucky enough, and we're talking about some of these extremely isolated islands, a lot of them many hundreds, some of them thousands of miles from any other landmass, if you're one of the lucky creatures to finally make it to that island, very often you'd have very little competition. That allows a lot of leeway in terms of what you can do evolutionarily speaking. So, you know, you can make things like a walking parrot if you don't have, for example, predators around to make you want to fly. You can just do these amazing things with evolution that you can't do on the mainland because you have a lot of competitors, you have a lot of restrictions on you. But the same thing that makes islands this wonderful playground for evolution make them also one of the most dangerous places to be if you happen to be have evolved there in the absence of all these competitors or predators, as this story is about, and all of a sudden the predators are introduced. And that is basically the rub of my story, Rat Island.
Well, one of the, I guess the most odd species is the kakapo. Am I saying that correctly?
I was wondering about that, too, until I started talking to the Kiwis, the New Zealanders. The kakapo, I believe, is the one you're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, thank you.
The flightless parrot. Yeah, the world's biggest parrot, the kakapo. They look like a big, green, shrub-colored owl, if you will. I mean, they're almost 2 feet tall. They weigh up to 9 pounds. They're heavy, and they waddle around on the forest floor. They lost their ability to fly a long time ago, and what they do is they become this avian equivalent of a possum or a rabbit. You know, they wander around on the forest floor. They climb trees. You know, they're vegetarians. They grab fruits from the trees. They'll eat tussocks of grass and whatnot. And as I say, they're flightless, and they lay their great eggs on the ground. They take a long time to mature. Sometimes, some years, they won't even mate at all. So that this, the explorers first found them in New Zealand. Of course, these things would waddle right up to them, you know, and they would crawl around on their heads, and you know, they came with no instinctual fear of people, and that's kind of giving away why the kakapo is such a big star in this story, and that they are one of the animals that took it really hard when people finally discovered their sanctuary in New Zealand.
How would an animal like that protect itself from predators?
When they evolved in New Zealand, they didn't have ground predators to worry about. What they did have was they had some raptors, some eagles, and one of them was a very huge one that they think might have preyed on things as big as ostriches. They had a group of family of birds there called moas, you might have heard of. But for the kakapo's part, yeah, it survived on its camouflage. And whenever it was threatened from the air, it would basically freeze. You know, if it wasn't moving, you couldn't see it, you know, and if it, you know, if you were looking right at it, you'd think, again, it was a piece of shrubbery. And that's how it got along for so long. Now, the other interesting thing about the kakapo is that it exudes this, for whatever reason, they think it might have to do something with sexual attraction, but it exudes this odd smell about it. Some people really like it. Some people find it musty. Some people find it sweet. But whatever the case, it has this fragrance about it. And, of course, this was always something that was an advantage when all you have is other kakapos around. But when you have suddenly these animals that can smell out a kakapo and would like to eat a kakapo, it became a huge disadvantage.
Okay, so we have this lovely, smelly bird that is well camouflaged, and everything is working quite well for it for the longest time, and then the rats.
Yeah, the rats. Well, you know, the rats came along with people, and people, New Zealand was one of the last major islands to be settled. They were settled along the line with many of the other islands of the Pacific by the Polynesians and their ancestors. They came along about 800, 700 years ago, and most of these seafaring canoes, they brought rats with them. They brought the rats along for eating. They brought them along for a source of steady protein. You know, they would actually plant them in the forest. They would take them off the canoes, you know, and very ceremoniously release them into the forest, and voila, they have a reproducing source of protein, because they didn't know where they were going to land. They didn't know what they would find. But the rats were something that kakapos and other flightless birds and many other birds of the islands had never dealt with before. And as you might know, rats are very fond of a lot of different things. They're omnivores. They've got a wide Catholic diet. They happen to like eggs. They happen to be very good carnivores, as it turns out, too, and they love the chicks of little birds and rats. Another thing about rats, a lot of them are very good climbers, and so it doesn't matter even if you're nesting in a tree, if you're a rat, you can usually get to it, and that's what happened in New Zealand. The rats came with people, along with a lot of other predators that followed them, and that was the beginning of the demise for many of the bird species in New Zealand.
Are they capable of causing a species complete extinction?
Yeah, and in fact, they vie with the domestic cat, as it turns out, which, when left feral, becomes a feral cat. They vie with our own domestic cat for being probably one of the two or three species with the most extinctions credited to their name. There's three species of rats that have largely invaded most of the islands of Oceania, and one species of cats. You might have an argument there of who's the worst, but yeah, they have been tallied upwards of 100 different species owing their extinction to rats.
Well, why can't they just integrate with the local ecosystem?
Well, that's the thing about these island ecosystems. They have evolved in the absence of the rats. And so when a rat comes along, these are animals that have not learned to deal with rats. They'll nest on the ground. You know, they'll nest in places where, you know, a rat would very easily take advantage of it. They don't have the same sort of defenses. They don't know enough to retaliate, to defend themselves against a rat. And that's the tragic part. In many cases, the bird will just sit there and the rat will eat it alive.
Cheery. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking about animal conservation with Will Stolzenberg, the author of Rat Island. Okay, back to the kakapo. It was very close to extinction at one point. How close?
If you consider that up until 1980, they didn't know the whereabouts of a single female kakapo, that's how close to extinction it was. This bird kind of started disappearing towards the turn of the 20th century. On the 1900s is when a lot of the invaders of New Zealand began mowing their way through the kakapo population, but people noticed them missing, but they didn't pay much attention. They started looking in the 1950s, and lo and behold, they couldn't find any. They mounted these major expeditions into some of the last, most remote and rugged territories of New Zealand and just couldn't find any. They would come up with maybe one in an expedition, another, you know, 10 years ago by, they'd find another one or two. They couldn't find any females until finally they came up with one in 1980. So when you consider that until 1980, they were looking at a species that, even though they knew the whereabouts or thought they knew the whereabouts of a few males, this bird was functionally extinct as far as anyone knew.
Well, once people actually realized how dire the situation was, can you tell us about some of the conservation efforts around that?
This is one of the most intensive conservation rescues of all time, to my mind. Once they realized what they had, they finally did find a few females back in 1980, and then within a year or two of finding this population of about 200 kakapos in the south end of New Zealand, just as they found them, the cats also found them. So they had to rescue these last kakapo, and were able to save about 50 of them. And at that point, they realized they were going to have to intensively manage them. And that means that they were guarding every single nest. They took them to an island. They cleared it of rats and other predators. And they had people come out and watch over them. They actually had cameras mounted on their nests. If the nests weren't made to the specifications, if they thought there were dangers, they would build them a little platform. They would build them covers to keep the rain out. They had little door chimes. If they were watching these things through remote cameras, and if a rat or some other intruder happened upon the nest, it would ring an alarm that would sound in the caretaker's tent, and they would come rushing, or they would have an explosive device to scare the predator away. But this is what it took to bring the eggs off to hatching, and then the chicks, which take a long time to mature, off to wandering away as they do. It was just, as I say, it was 24/7, and on islands that had to be, you know, guarded and quarantined against any visitors in order just to keep pace with the predators.
Well, that seems rather energy intensive, doesn't it?
It absolutely does, but that was really, I mean, they had a choice, and they had seen it happen with some other species that they were looking at. Some other birds had disappeared. This was probably the most unique parrot in the world, and they had a choice. They were either going to, again, take this thing in intensive care, guard it 24/7, or they weren't going to have any kakapos. This was one of the three most ubiquitous birds in all of New Zealand when people discovered the continent, and here we were in the late 1980s, 1990s, and we had a couple handfuls of these birds on Earth, and so they knew what the stakes were. The idea was, how much do you want to save this species from extinction? And they stepped up.
Definitely, according to your book, conservation has really been a developing field. And one of the earliest methods to deal with foreign predators has been to bring in other predators.
That was a lesson that didn't get learned quite soon enough in New Zealand. And they tried that, practiced it, and failed many times with that. What they did was that, you know, when they finally realized that we have an alien invasive problem here in New Zealand, and in fact it's wiping out our heritage, our bird heritage, which is what New Zealand is all about, they brought in predators. But the first thing they did, and this is one of the other, they weren't out to save birds at first, I should mention that. One of the things that they did in New Zealand, it was good sheep country. They imported sheep. They also imported rabbits for sportsmen. Now, the rabbits like to eat the same things that sheep do in many occasions, so they decided, well, we've got too many rabbits now. So what did they do? They brought in a cast of the weasel relatives. They called the Mustelid clan, if you will. They're weasels and stoats and ferrets you might be familiar with. They introduced these animals to get rid of the rabbits. Well, guess what? the Mustelids, the weasels and stoats and whatnot, decided, well, these, you know, rabbits are too hard to catch, but there sure are these easy birds, these very friendly birds that don't know anything about us, and they're just ripe for the pickings. And so what happens is the animals they brought in to rid these enemies of their sheep turned on the native birds and just totally threw everything in arrears, and, well, one of the great ecological disasters of all time ensued.
I'm laughing, but it's not funny. That's awful.
No, I mean, when you consider that, again, these were defenseless birds, and it's not like they're, you know, they understand the game, and they're playing cat and mouse. They're just sitting there. They're just easy meat for the most part.
There seem to be a lot of opportunities to refine this process, really. How often do these kind of foreign infestations happen?
Unfortunately, it happens time and again, and the lessons seem to have to be learned over and over again. It's happened on most of the continents, you know, against some of the scientists' objections, these ill-advised animals are introduced, and it's one of the major problems for biodiversity these days is the introduction of, as we call them, invasive alien species. But again, a lot of times people don't think, they don't give it enough thought about what the repercussions will be before they introduce something. And there's also the problem with accidental introductions, such as the brown tree snake in Guam, which wiped out 12 of the 13 bird species, and now they're having a campaign to finally get rid of that animal. But they don't think they're ever going to be able to do that. That's the problem. Sometimes when you let these these dragons loose in the Garden of Eden, there's no going back.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back with more of author Will Stolzenberg and his book, Rat Island, after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at how biotechnology is supercharging the toolkit for customizing our pets, and how science is changing our relationship with the animal world. We're joined by science writer Emily Anthes to talk about her book, Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. And guest host Rochelle Saunders talks to futurist George Dvorsky, director of the Rights of Non-Human Persons program at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, about legal and scientific efforts to expand basic rights to animals other than humans. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and today's topic is animal protection and conservation, particularly after the introduction of an invasive predator species. My guest is Will Stolzenberg, author of Rat Island. Now, when we're talking about conservation, there is a great deal of disagreement about what exactly should be done about dwindling populations, and in some cases, whether anything should be done at all. Some people think that extinctions are just part of the natural cycle, correct?
They do. And I'd say a lot of other people, or I would hope more people, and myself included, have a difference of opinion about that, and that we would very much readily agree that extinction is a natural process. But the rate of extinction that we're seeing these days is not natural. I mean, depending on who you want to quote, we're upwards of 100 to 1,000 times the natural background rate of extinction. So what we're looking at now, you could say that extinction is natural, but the rate at what we're seeing today is anything but natural.
Well, maybe give me the other side's best argument for why we shouldn't interfere.
Some of the arguments I've heard is that, again, you know, it's the survival of the fittest. People are, we're nature too. So why shouldn't we just be considered a viable part of the mix? And if other species can't put up with our excesses, then they should be allowed to go extinct. And there are others of us who believe that, well, no, wait a minute, I think it may be a little premature to assume that, you know, this is all going to be for the better of mankind if we let these species go extinct. The idea being that, well, the reason that we are who we are and why we came to be who we are is because we grew up, evolutionarily speaking, we grew up in a world of many, many species of great biodiversity, and we are basically tearing this very support system down around us. So the idea that we can do without a lot of these species and do well without a lot of these species, I think is an experiment that a lot of us are loath to try.
Well, even if there is agreement on the fact that something has to be done, you still have to decide on a course of action. So generally, what are you working with? What are the options?
It's basically a matter of triage. It's how badly do you want to save every species and which ones need it most? And so it comes down to a matter of which ones can we afford to and which ones can we actually, do we have the technology to save, which is kind of where Rat Island is heading. And that is that in some cases, you know, that there are cases, I have to admit, out there where it may be too late, where we really can't turn the clock back, and it may be best, and I hate to say this, it may be best if we turn our efforts, our limited resources, in favor of another creature or plant or whatever it might be that has a better chance of making it.
Well, some of the methods that you talked about in the book are really interesting. One of the points of your book is talking about how a whole island was cleared of rats to make a place that the birds could be moved that were endangered.
Yeah, and that's one of the costs, but that's one of the beauties of this whole idea of saving the island species. And what I'm writing about mainly in Rat Island is this technique, which is in many ways a grim one, but in many ways a very, very uplifting one, in that the idea is if you figured out what the problem is, and the problem is we have these invasive species on islands that are tearing into populations of naive species of creatures, what if you just get rid of the invaders? can you do that? Well, until about 20 or 30 years ago, we didn't think we had the know-how to get rid of an entire island of rats. We just didn't think it was possible. You know, they can dive into holes. They can, you know, very wary. They're so fecund and productive. I mean, there's just no way you're ever going to get the last rat. So they just kind of threw up their hands and said, we're just going to have to live with them. Well, over the last 10 or 20 years, there's another way of thinking about this. Some better poisons have been developed, some better techniques for spreading it via the air, helicopter, GPS systems. And now they found out they can not only knock back some of these predators, such as rats and cats and goats and pigs and all the other ones that we brought out there, they can actually get rid of every last one. And so what they can do is they can set that island back to a more pristine time. And indeed, they find that when they do that, miraculous things happen. We have basically resurrections of these island faunas that all they really needed was a chance to survive without the invaders.
And how would one do that physically, clear an island of rats?
Rats in particular, the main weapon against rats these days is poison. And the main poison that we're using is, I've not been involved, but I'm a reporter. I'm not just the messenger. But the main poison that's being used is an anticoagulant, a blood thinner. It's called Brodifacoum. And it can be administered via these pellets that can be dropped via the air. The rats eat it, and the rats only need one dose of it. And that rat will die within a few days to 7 days, somewhere around that, 5 to 7 days a week. And they can place this bait. We have the systems now. We can place this bait within the nose of every single rat on that island. You can get these pellets into some very, very remote places. And it has been shown that you can go to some of the most rugged topographies on Earth, and you can annihilate every single rat on them through this poison.
So not everybody agrees with those kind of things. Your book had a section that was basically a discussion of how angry people were about one of those islands being cleared. People like the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals took issue with it, and a number of other animal rights groups, correct?
That's true, yeah, and you can understand it. I mean, there is a philosophy out there that we should do no harm to any of God's creatures. And I certainly have some sympathies with those philosophies. And so the idea is that these aren't just rats. These are animals deserving of our respect. And therefore, who are we, who are any of us, to be playing God and determine who lives and who dies? The counterargument to that of the conservationists is that, well, we have a responsibility because we are the ones who have released these menaces on the islands in the first place. And if it's not for us, we will basically be sentencing these multi-million years products of evolution to certain death. So, yes, indeed, we are playing God, but it's something that we feel ethically responsible for doing.
Well, and let's be honest. When we're talking about something like rats, there seems to be less public concern about potentially inhumane eradication, right?
In my research, I found that was the case, that there's oftentimes, unless it's right in the public's eye, say for one of the Channel Islands, right, you know, within sight of Los Angeles, for example, there's not a whole lot of uproar about poisoning rats, at least not as much as there would be if, say, they were going after a population of cats, which, you know, have a lot more fans out there. So, yeah, there is a little bit of prejudice and bias going on as to which animals deserve to be saved or spared.
And the, you know, relative level of public outcry has a different effect on sort of the governmental approvals for these kinds of projects.
Well, yeah, the ability of governments to do that is oftentimes it varies from country to country. One of the reasons that, you know, the New Zealanders were able to pioneer some of these techniques is because, number one, they were up against a wall like nothing we have ever seen. I mean, half of their bird fauna was basically extinguished by these foreign invaders. And so, in fact, they've actually got a program now. It's a predator-free New Zealand. It's not just some of the outlying islands. They're actually thinking about going after all of the invasives on that island. But it came about because, again, their backs were so far up against that wall. They had already lost half of their natural heritage in terms of their avian fauna. And the other thing is that, you know, some places like the United States are very litigious, and that has a lot to do with how rapidly and how willfully some conservation organizations are to perhaps tackle some of these issues. You know, it certainly is going to make it a lot easier if there's not a lot of public outcry and a lot of legal hurdles.
And that was one of the issues, is the situation became so dire after trying so long to get approval for these kinds of projects.
Yes, and that was and that even faced some of the early conservationists in New Zealand, whereby, you know, there are differences of opinion as to how there used to be, at least, differences of opinion as to how dangerous the threat really is. And it wasn't until some of the conservationists who were accused of crying wolf, well, it turns out, you know, after the certain species went extinct, I think the light was turned on for some of those others who were suggesting a wait-and-see approach. Well, the wait-and-see approach, what that amounted to in New Zealand was extinction, and that really cleared the way for a little bit more drastic action. And again, when those examples are used in other countries, they can make a pretty powerful argument for why it's not a good idea to stand back. We have examples from around the world now whereby invasives not only make a dent, but they can entirely annihilate a population or a species. And so the handwriting's on the wall. It just takes somebody to stand up and do something about it.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Will Stolzenberg, the author of Rat Island, Predators in Paradise and the World's Greatest Wildlife Rescue. Okay, so let's talk about trying to clear the island of the rats. That went down, it seemed to have gone very, very well. And then the researchers came back 6 months later. What happened?
Yeah, well, on Rat Island, which was the biggest experiment of its time for removing rats in North America, again, a lot of the techniques were exported from New Zealand, but this was the first major aerial eradication in the United States. And indeed, the initial results looked really good. It went off without a hitch. It was in a very difficult place. Rat Island's about 1,100 miles west of the coast of Alaska. It's way out there in the Bering Chain. They had perfect weather. Almost it had never been seen before by many of the people who'd spent their lives in the Aleutians. And so they were able to complete the poisoning in what they had budgeted for 6 weeks. It came off in about a week, so they were delighted that they were. It was like the gods were smiling on them to save Rat Island, and they did what they came to do. They got rid of the rats. When they came back about 6 months later, they could find no traces of any live rats. But unfortunately, and this was a problem they had somewhat feared, but not to the extent that they found it. They found over 400 birds that had been mistakenly killed. These are non-target animals that were not supposed to have died in the crossfire that ended up eating either sick and dying rats or other animals, gulls perhaps, that had eaten some of the sick and dying rats. Another thing that had gone on there was that they had made an inventory of some of the birds they suspected would be susceptible to these poisonings. They only had a few pairs of bald eagles on the island. They figured, well, that one, you know, that's probably not going to be a big problem. Well, somehow or other, word got out along the Aleutian chain that there was food, and maybe it was the idea that there's rats dying there, but the eagles flocked in, and several dozen eagles were killed, and that made a big splash. So, yeah, there was this concern after the Rat Island was used as a sort of an experiment, not to say that Rat Island itself wasn't worth the effort. I mean, this was a tremendous seabird colony that had been wiped out, but there were much bigger targets in the Aleutians, and Rat Island was deemed a good place to practice. After Rat Island, when things didn't go quite as people had hoped, they had just a few too many deaths for a lot of people's comforts, it kind of raised the question, because of tackling some of these bigger islands. One of the bigger islands that had been the goal from the get-go was an island called Kiska, which housed probably the largest colony of a small bird called the least auklet. These animals congregate in these tremendous masses. It's just one of the world's natural wonders. Millions of them. Nobody can even count them. There's so many, and they look like swarms of locusts against the sky coming in to breed. And these talus rock piles It's a lava flow off the north end of Kiska Island, and again, it's one of the greatest gatherings of wildlife on the planet. But that, like Rat Island, had been infested by rats. These came a lot later. These rats, we think, came onto Kiska during World War II, aboard some of the ships, either the Japanese or the Americans who were fighting there as stowaways, made their way past the Kiska volcano, which separated them at the time, and over years finally got there. And when biologists finally realized that, they realized they were taking a big dent out of this tremendous colony of little seabirds on the north end of the island. Well, again, there's not too many colonies of these birds called the auklets. There's only a few places where they really like to nest, and they do it in great numbers. So this carried some great meaning to be able to tackle the island of Kiska. Well, Kiska is 10 times as big as Rat Island. So when they realized that they were going to have these sorts of problems, for example, the non-target kill of eagles on Rat Island, it kind of cooled a lot of the ardors for doing battle with Kiska right away, given that Kiska is a much bigger island. Kiska has fish on it. Kiska has a lot of eagles on it. And so right now I think they're kind of retreating, kind of looking over things again and questioning about whether or not what they want to do, if they can do anything about the rats on Kiska.
But people have gone back to Kiska since then.
People have gone back to Kiska, and they've seen, you know, the carnage. But here's the thing, and this may be to the birds' favor. The carnage that they were expecting, and at one point they were thinking that that tremendous colony of auklets may have been gone within 30 years. Well, 10 years after that, we find that it seems that they may be, not that they can really count them very well, but they're still there. I mean, you can still see these tremendous flights of auklets, and so they're thinking something else is going on, something that they hadn't anticipated. Perhaps the rats are dying back every year. Perhaps, you know, this is such an extreme, rugged, and dire situation for rats to live that the weather knocks them back every year. Of course, they don't have many seabirds to feed on during the winter. They have to make it by on, you know, flotsam from the sea. You know, they have to forage along the coastline. There's parts vegetation to eat, but they don't have this wonderful manna from heaven every year during the winter from these auklets. And so something else is going on there. The auklets seem to be holding their own. However, there is still this fear, and this is something that all of us are going to be facing here in a warming world. With climate change proceeding as it is, there are concerns that the winters may become a little less harsh on Kiska. And if the winters are what are holding the rats back, or what are knocking them back every year to the point that they really can't get on top of that population of auklets at Kiska, it may be that climate change, global warming, is going to make that a more hospitable place for rats, and therefore give them the upper hand. And then at that point, you know, all bets are off. At that point, maybe the worst, the most dire predictions about annihilating the auklets on Kiska will come true.
Well, I don't want to ask too much about this because I want people to go buy your book. But what happened to the Kakapo, sir? How are they doing now?
I was just looking at their population figures the other day, and since I wrote the book, there was some 130 some odd. I think there's maybe a few less now. The Kakapo population is largely dependent, besides the predator issue, is largely dependent on the fruiting of a certain tree that they tend to feed off. It's the rimu tree and the fruits of the rimu. And the weather situation there has been such that there has not been a great fruiting in the past year, and so there hasn't been a lot of breeding. The animals are kind of stalemated right now. They're not going anywhere, which is a big concern. They're trying to get them breeding on a second island, but for the most part, most all the kakapos, the breeding kakapos in the world, all 120 some odd, or maybe 130 at the most, they're now breeding for the most part on a single island. So you realize the problem here of all eggs in one basket. You know, you can imagine
literally,
a big major catastrophe could be all that she wrote for the kakapo. And so to say that we're holding steady with, you know, 120 some odd birds is really a precarious statement.
Well, we're out of time, but it's wonderful to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you. I certainly certainly appreciate it. It's been wonderful speaking with you.
You can find a link to Will Stolzenberg, the author of Rat Island, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And since you're there already, maybe click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, so that you can stay up to date on show news. Or you could keep clicking to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the podcast, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.